It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, as the Scripps National Spelling Bee gets rolling, we ask you for the words that you struggle to spell.
First, a new report out today by the Children's Health Alliance of Wisconsin shows that almost every sudden unexpected infant death in Wisconsin in 2013 involved unsafe sleeping conditions. In fact, all but one of the 56 cases.
Milwaukee has long been known to have one of the highest infant mortality rates in the country, but Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Crocker Stevenson says that the rest of the state isn't far behind and that unsafe sleeping is a problem Wisconsin-wide.
Stevenson's report on unsafe sleeping and infant mortality in 2011 won the National Academy of Sciences, National Academy of Engineering, and Institute of Medicine Award. He joins us now to talk about this report out today. Crocker, thanks for joining the show.
Yeah, hi.
So let's first talk about this this phrase, this diagnosis, sudden unexpected infant death. What do we mean by that?
Yeah, it's kind of a broader phrase than SIDS, but sudden unexpected infant death almost defines itself. It's the death of an infant less than 12 months old, which is what an infant is, that occurs suddenly and unexpectedly and whose cause of death is not immediately obvious before an investigation. So what the key part of that phrase is not immediately obvious. So a child with a brain tumor or an infant with a congenital disability of some sort would not fall into this class. So these are kids that apparently are apparently healthy and they just suddenly die.
So obviously we would like to know why these infants die. It's unexplained, hence this new report. So talk about the findings. What was this report trying to figure out? What factors did they look at?
Well, as time has gone by, it's become more and more nuanced, these definitions. And in 2011, the Academy of Pediatrics released a seminal paper in which they analyzed a dozen or so risk factors that contribute to sudden infant death, and these risk factors range from co-sleeping, which would be parents or other children or a pet sleeping on the same sleep surface as a child, as an infant, to prenatal care, to smoking, to room temperature, breastfeeding, all sorts of factors that are that can contribute to the likelihood that a child might suffer from a sudden unexpected infant death.
And so keying in on unsafe sleeping, that was what this report really found very commonly associated with these sudden unexpected infant deaths. What Yes. kinds of unsafe sleeping kept coming up again and again?
You know, the thing about figuring out a risk is that it's very hard to understand how risky that risk is because we don't know what's going on in the general public. For example, we hear all the time about parents sleeping with their children and children dying in those circumstances, suffocating while sleeping with their parents. But what we don't, so we know that happens a lot, much more than we would like in Milwaukee County about 10 times a year. But what we don't know is how prevalent that behavior is. So is it just 20 people in Milwaukee County sleeping with their kids, and half the time those kids end up dead? Or is it several hundred thousand people sleep with their children, and in the small amount of children die? Same thing with smoking. It's hard to evaluate how big of a risk factor smoking is. So what this study did is it looked at children at a particular age, you know, under 12 months, but also at a certain susceptibility. For example, they're very little; they're 2 to 4 months generally, and they might be prematurely born, and then so they have the struggle that they're already engaged in, and just taking a deep breath, and then added onto that are these additional risk factors, and usually it's a combination of risk factors that are at play when a child just suddenly, for no apparent reason, dies.
And can you lay out some of the risk factors that they considered there?
Well, probably the basic phrase always say is ABC. All babies should sleep alone. The A means alone. B, on their backs. And C, in a crib or bassinet without blankets, pillows, plush toys. And these are all very important things that any parent can do in order to reduce the risk of SIDS. They've now added also smoking. The parents shouldn't smoke. Moms shouldn't smoke while they're pregnant. Nobody should smoke around the baby once the child is born. Smoking and then also that it's helpful for a child to be in the same room as parents. I had twins, and our doctor advised us to put the twins in another room, or we would never sleep. We kept them in our room, and it's true, we never slept, because you're always listening. But that's something that I think is very natural for parents to do, is to listen and to be attuned to their child's sleep.
Talking to Crocker Stevenson from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, a new report lays out some maybe causes or factors associated with sudden unexplained infant deaths in Wisconsin. Now, Crocker, this whole conversation is part of a wider effort, especially in Milwaukee, to reduce infant mortality. Can you talk about the role of trying to tackle unsafe sleeping plays in that wider effort?
I think the issue of sleep has become an unexpected problem here in Milwaukee. The idea was, well, you know, these are all sort of simple things. Put your child on his or her back. Don't put a bunch of pillows in there. Breastfeed. These sorts of things all seem like things that that a parent that wants to keep the child safe can easily do. And that the by far the largest driver of infant mortality, both in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin and in the world, is premature birth. And wrestling with premature birth is much more complicated. Causes of premature birth can range from racism, poverty, air pollution, bad diets, unhealthy childhood that your mother had, and so many of these issues that are addressed in order to combat premature birth just seem so big and so difficult. So here in Milwaukee, they thought, well, we could just knock down infant mortality by just getting people to stop sleeping with their kids. And as it's turned out to be a very, very difficult process. So in Milwaukee County, the number of children that die while sleeping with a parent or in other unsafe sleep conditions, such as a couch or with a friend or whatever, that number has just not gone down in these years that the Milwaukee has been pressing for safe sleep behaviors.
Now, on the show, we've talked about efforts to tackle that premature birth situation. That's where maybe a bigger difference could be made. Do you see over time a shift in focus? The sleep thing maybe isn't paying off. We're going to try to tackle this bigger, way more complicated problem of premature birth?
In several counties in Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Dane, and several cities, Beloit and Racine, there is an effort called the Life Course Initiative, and this is an effort to address the root causes of preterm birth by addressing those upstream issues. Now, those are very complicated and very probably they would be politically impossible to fund, except that there's a lot of money from the Red Cross and Blue Shield settlements. So Milwaukee gets a big chunk of money to implement programs that are directed towards reducing preterm birth. And some of those programs are programs to involve fathers in their kids' lives or help fathers find jobs or to stabilize families, because stabilized families are healthier, and healthier families have healthier children. Healthier children don't die before they turn one. Job skills, food availability, healthy food availability, obesity, and other health practices, smoking cessation, breastfeeding. Those are all sort of upstream programs that we have here in Milwaukee County that are designed to create a healthier life for both women and children. And that the hope is, and this may take decades, but the hope is that as that each generation is a little bit healthier, or maybe considerably healthier, and that we move away from the cycle of injury and death.
Crocker, thanks for joining us today.
Sure.
That's Crocker Stevenson, reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at a new report out today on infant deaths and unsafe sleeping conditions.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll find out what the future could hold for the state's prevailing wage law.
First, over the last few decades, jails in America have seen significant increases in population. On any given day, there are about 730,000 people locked up in American jails. That's more than triple the jail population of 1983, and it's costing quite a bit.
The United States Department of Justice estimated that local communities spent $22.2 billion on jails in 2011. But according to our next guest, communities are actually spending much more on jails, and policymakers and taxpayers may not be aware of everything that goes into the ongoing funding of jails. So how much are we actually spending, and are there ways to save some of that money?
Joining us now is Chris Henriksen. He's the director of the Cost-Benefit Analysis Unit at the Vera Institute of Justice and lead author of the new report, The Price of Jails, Measuring the Taxpayer Cost of Local Incarceration. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So in the past reports, you've tackled the cost of the nation's prison population. Why look at jails this time around?
Well, to start, often many confuse the difference between prisons and jails. Prisons are state-run and federally run facilities for those that have been sentenced of a crime, whereas jails are locally administered by counties and cities, and most of the inmates in jails have not yet been convicted of a crime. They're legally presumed innocent.
And as we mentioned, jail populations in America have soared in recent decades. Jails are holding three times as many people now as they were in 1983. And the big question there is why? What's changed?
Well, that's right. And there's 3,000 counties across the country, and in each county, the drivers of the increase in jail populations is going to vary. So in some places, it may be arresting practices. In other cases, it might be the length of court proceedings.
Now, where does the money come from to pay for jails?
Well, by and large, funding for jail almost exclusively comes from counties and cities' general funds. So the tax revenue that's drawn upon the local tax base, whether it's property tax or sometimes a local income tax, is funding the county and city jails. They are not state-funded, and they're not federally funded.
So for prisons, who funds prisons?
Prisons are almost exclusively funded by the state general fund. So the state income tax that one pays on an annual basis is largely what funds state prisons.
Now, when we're talking jails, who is typically in a jail? Who's being held there?
Well, about 60% are those who are awaiting trial, legally presumed innocent. They could be awaiting trial because it's a lengthy court proceeding. They might be facing felony charges. But many are simply too poor to post bail, or they might find themselves in jail regularly because of being picked up on the street for a minor offense.
Now, the U.S. Department of Justice estimated that local communities spent $22.2 billion on jails in the year 2011. Can you talk about the different factors that went into that number?
Sure. The Department of Justice uses information that the U.S. Census collects on expenditures at each county. And within those county expenditures, they take a look at various departments, such as education, healthcare, and corrections. And they derive the $22.2 billion figure by looking at correctional institutions or jails that are run at the county level. And so while that's a good estimation of the cost of jails to the sheriffs and the jail administrators that run the jail, we found that it's quite often that there are large expenses outside of jail budgets. So one of the largest can be health care that's provided to inmates. In large cities in particular, these are provided by public health departments or local public hospitals, and the cost of the care for an inmate can average about 10% in our study sample, so you'd be missing those costs. In other cases, there's some counties that pay for benefits for jail employees through a central county account, and the methodology where you take a look at the jail's budget, will miss these expenses.
And it sounds like the tracking the money that goes to pay for jails can get a little tricky because it doesn't all come from the same pot, so we end up underestimating.
That's right. So in New York City, for example, or Dallas is similar, the cost of salaries for jail employees is in the jail budget, and that's all pretty straightforward. But the cost of health and hospital care is funded through an entirely different city budget, and then the cost of pensions and other fringe benefits for jail employees, and employees actually in all the city, are funded through a separate account. So you need to be looking at all these accounts to have the total true cost or true price of the jail.
So given all that, how much would you say that we're actually spending on jails in America?
It's hard to say. We found in our study sample that about a quarter, in a quarter of the jurisdictions, more than 20% of the cost was in outside agencies and was as high as 50% in New York City. It's difficult to extrapolate because we don't know if our sample is representative exactly, but to the extent it is, the cost of nationwide is surely close to $30 billion than it is, $22.2 billion.
How would you say these numbers are affecting the cities, the counties that have to pay for jails?
Well, on the one hand, in a sense, it doesn't. So, at the local level, county commissioners and budget officials and even jail administrators are well aware of this issue. But the reason that we think it's important to shine light on this is that there's increasing attention on jails and jail populations and the rising number of those in jails. And many cities and counties are looking to reduce the numbers of those in their jails. And that presents an opportunity because the savings afforded through the downsizing jails presents funds that can be redirected to other health and social services that might better meet the needs of many that are already in the jail today. But you can't get a handle of what that opportunity is for reinvestment without a true and accurate understanding of how much money is currently being spent today, and that's why this is relevant right now.
We're talking with Chris Henriksen from the Vera Institute of Justice about a new study about the true cost of jails. Turns out they're costing taxpayers more than we might expect. And Chris, you were talking about how it might be better to lower the population of those in jail and focus instead on things like health and social services. Is that the secret to lowering these jail costs, the incentive, the money, and getting people out of jails?
Well, the only way to safely reduce jail costs is to reduce the number in the jails. And as jails downsize and they attain levels of inmate declines at certain thresholds, there's opportunities to close down certain housing units. And so we've seen this in two of the sites in our study. So Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Springfield, Massachusetts, the jails there have downsized by more than 30%, and that afforded them the opportunity to close down the housing units, or with what are often called pods, which are the dormitories where the inmates reside in the evening. These housing units typically have about 60 beds. It varies by county, but typically about 50 or 60. And they're full-time staffed by one guard. And because jails are 24/7 operations, one post actually requires six employees for three shifts a day, and you need to double that to account for the vacation and training that's, of course, required for all employees. So once you reach that threshold of about 50 or 60, there's an opportunity to relieve approximately five or six employees, which is what we found in our study sample. And once you attain that level of savings, the question that counties and cities next need to deal with is, well, what should we do with these funds? Should they be returned to the general fund to fund other areas of government, or should they be spent elsewhere to address the needs of those that had formerly been in those housing units before they were closed?
Do you think we can have fewer people in jail without sacrificing some aspect of public safety?
Sure, and we've seen evidence to this. New York City and New York State are both heralded as sort of the leaders in criminal justice reform and the downsizing of prisons and jails. New York State has the prison population has declined by 30% over the past 15 years as the rate of crime rates have declined. And this is largely in part because the jail population and steps taken in New York City to reduce the correctional population, whilst, as has been widely reported, New York City is now safe as it's ever been.
We're talking right now with Chris Henriksen from the Vera Institute for Justice about the cost of jails in America. Chris is the lead author of a new report that finds jails are costing taxpayers more than they might expect. And we want to know your thoughts on this. What do you think about the cost of jails? Would you rather see some of that money spent elsewhere in your community? Or do you think it's a necessary investment, maybe a good one? And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Chris Henriksen from the Vera Institute for Justice about the cost of jails in America.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we, or maybe your community, are spending too much on jails? What do you think should change? Do you think there should be more alternatives to incarceration in a jail? And if you are involved or have been involved with jails in any capacity, an inmate, an employee, somebody in the criminal justice system, interested in your thoughts on the matter as well. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to the phones now. We've got Jim on the line in Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Hi, I'm a criminal defense attorney. And I also teach business law to the Native American Community College. I just wanted to get your guest comment. There is a University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee extension study approximately 3 years ago that statistically showed that the United States had the highest rate of incarceration of any known state in the world, any known country in the world. Second was Rwanda. Third was Cuba. And of the 50 states, they were based on per 100,000 population. The highest state of incarceration of any of the 50 states was Wisconsin, with Oklahoma being second. So that according to, and I believe that was the Milwaukee study was accurate, that according to this study, that the state of Wisconsin has the highest rate of incarceration of any known legal entity in the world. I want to know your guest comments. Thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Jim, and thank you for giving us that context. Jim referencing a UW-Milwaukee study. What do you think about those numbers there, Chris?
So I know that he's quite right about how the United States compares with other countries, and it's not just developed Western nations, but all nations. The United States has by far the highest incarceration rate, and not only in terms of comparisons with other countries today, but we're actually at a point where incarceration has deviated quite a bit from what it looked like historically prior to the 1970s. With respect to Wisconsin, the rates of incarceration vary widely across 50 states. I'm not familiar with how those states rank, but it's of course true then whichever the 50 states has the highest incarceration rate would by extension have the highest incarceration rate in the world.
Do you know why the United States has that distinction?
That's a very good question and that many wrestle with, and there's really no one answer that's well known. There's been, ever since the 1970s, there's been increased interest in using the criminal justice system to dissuade and assist the use of drugs, the so-called war on drugs. In the 1990s, federal legislation and truth and sentencing legislation had the effect of increasing the lengths of time that people spend in prisons. It's going to vary by each state, and within each county, the drivers of the jail populations differ. But I think we're arriving at a point where both Republicans and Democrats are acknowledging that we're past a point of diminishing returns when it comes to the use of prison and jail to address our safety needs, and there's much wider interest in taking a look at how we use incarceration today than ever in recent memory.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, and we're going to go next to Kenneth joining us from Black River Falls. Hi, Kenneth.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, I just want to say that, you know, the Wisconsin DOC is trying to work at reducing the recidivism rate in corrections. So I think some of the problems is that you gotta look at the socioeconomic factors that the individuals, when they're leaving the institution, they're being put into an area where they've, you know, committed their crimes or their offenses, and there's nothing for them. And, you know, the DOC can only do so much to provide them these tools to improve themselves, but, you know, when it all comes down to it, it's actually the individual that has to make the choice.
And Kenneth, what do you think about looking for alternatives to jail instead of going that route when you're trying to reduce recidivism?
Oh, I'm totally for treatment, because in a lot of facilities you have different housed inmates, you know, that are different class levels that, you know, you might have an alcoholic or drug offenders mixed in with murderers and other, you know, individuals that have a higher crime rate or, you know, worse crime. So I'd put for, you know, treatment and facility, you know, treatments and stuff like that.
All right. Well, thank you for your call, Kenneth. Appreciate you you're calling us. And Chris, Kenneth saying that it can be tough when people get out of jail. There may not be options for them that are going to keep them from going back. What do you think about that argument?
Oh, it's absolutely true. Corrections departments across the country, not only state corrections departments, but also many jails, particularly jails in larger cities and counties, have invested in programming that's been proven by research to effectively reduce rates of recidivism. Oftentimes, there's only small portions of correction populations that are able to participate in programming, either for safety reasons or because of, you know, there's a limit to which participation can be mandated. But even still, reducing recidivism rates is only going to go so far at addressing mass incarceration, because it's not just always the choices of the individuals that are made, but also how the justice system responds. So whereas the response to an individual's choice, say for crime X, is today, you know, meted out with a prison sentence of 4 years, whereas opposed to several years ago, maybe it was 2 years. That has the effect of doubling the number in the jail for that for that crime. So it's about individual choices and helping people remediate, but it's also about how the justice system responds to crimes after they've occurred.
And Chris, just briefly as we wrap up, what are some success stories, alternatives to jails that are being tried out?
Well, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, in Bernalillo County, they've had great success in reducing jail populations, in part through things that seem obvious, administrative efficiencies, by funding new district attorney positions to expedite case processing, and working to reduce time to conduct probation violation hearings, so people are in jail for less time while they're waiting those hearings. But one front-end solution in that county is for the police department to, rather than make an arrest for certain crimes, to instead issue a citation, which is a civil penalty rather than a criminal penalty that could lead someone into jail.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
That was Chris Hendrickson. He's the director of the Cost-Benefit Analysis Unit at the Vera Institute of Justice and lead author of the new report, The Price of Jails, Measuring the Taxpayer Costs of Local Incarceration.